For most of us, turning 37 isn't a huge milestone, but for vaudeville turned silver screen turned two-time Grammy winning artist Judy Garland, her 37th birthday marked her 40th film with MGM Studios. In this episode of Bubbles and Pop, we take a look back at the life and legacy of the one and only Frances Ethel Gumm,
aka Judy Garland.
Hello and welcome to Bubbles and Pop, a pop culture podcast undertaken with a bottle of champers or whatever you may like to be drinking in hand. I'm Michael Pop Pinterbonner.
And I'm the fabulous Brendy Ford, aka Bubbles. Now you've tuned in to season one of Bubbles and Pop, where we're looking at the divas who have changed the pop culture landscape and as a result, the world we live in.
That's right, Bubbles, and today's episode is momentous because we are going way back in time, all the way back to the 1930s, along a yellow brick road, as we explore the career and cultural impact of everyone's favourite Judy, Judy Garland.
Oh my God.
Now, Judy Garland has left a massive impact on all of us, and I think particularly as members of the LGBTIAQ plus community,
yes,
we particularly connect with her. But Brendy, what is it about Judy Garland that stands out for you?
I think we, our community resonates with her a lot in regards to reflecting on her life and the struggle that she went through. Our community has gone through a struggle, but also there's so much hope and fabulousness around this one woman that I think she didn't realize how much change she brought about, but we actually can see it. I also just love the fact that like her family is literally, she and her family are literally from a very, very long line of camp individuals.
And we all like a little bit of camp.
We do.
Well, I love a little bit of camp.
It's like a Christmas tree.
I think for me, Judy Garland, you know, in addition to perhaps the more meaningful stuff that you highlighted, I just really like the songs. I love, you know, a camp bop, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, you know, is a hallmark of many a band.
Remixed at circuit.
Yes.
Always goes wild.
Get me the Wide Boys remix of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Give it like an eight drum behind
it. Just a bit of added to it.
Absolutely. Like, but today's show, we are going to look at the life and times of Judy Garland. And she had a very, very big life. And it wasn't a long life necessarily, but she packed a lot in. So we're not going to be able to cover off everything, but we're going to look at a couple of key things.
So let's delve deep into today's show. Judy Garland, born Frances Ethel Gumm in 1922, went on to conquer stage and screen with a music career that included 5 studio albums, 6 live albums, 31 compilation albums, and a whopping 67 singles. She also appeared in over 39 films by the time she was 37.
So it is a huge career to understand, and we are going to try and make sense of that by zooming in on the highlights. So, you know, if you were studying for an exam, this is the Cliff Notes version of Judy Garland. And we're going to look at Somewhere Over the Rainbow and its cultural impact and means to well, everyone, to the world. And we will also look at 2 biopics, one quite recently with Renee Zellweger in it called Judy, and one kind of going back a few years called A Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows. On to the show.
Mikey, that song is incredibly moving.
It takes me back all the way to 1992. When I had the starring role of Lead Munchkin in my primary school's production of, it's kind of with The Wizard of Oz.
You're like, I don't really know what we were doing, but I was a munchkin.
I was a munchkin, and there was Dorothy, and we got to, and there was no Tin Man.
Is it just book week?
No, we put it on. It was our end of year concert for our parents.
All right,
And I was very proud that I got to be a lead munchkin. So it takes me all the way back to that. But this song's history goes further than 1992 when I performed it. This song, Brendy, it goes all the way back to the 1930s.
Yeah, 1938 to be exact.
Yeah.
That was when it was recorded.
And, you know, it is a song that was written and recorded at a time in history when the world was perhaps not in the best of places. So we had obviously gone through World War One.
What's going on in the 30s, Mikey?
Well, the 30s was a very difficult time. I think the landscape in Europe was
a mess.
Yeah, it was changing, and it was not changing for the better.
No.
And, you know, I don't think we need to give people a history lesson on what was happening in Germany at that time. But I thought it was really interesting when I looked into this song and who wrote it, that it was written by two migrants of Russian Jewish descent. So by Yip Harburg and...
Harold Arlen.
Thank you. I can never say that one right. But yeah, it's written by two Jewish migrants. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, if you look at it and you put your little arts hat on.
Yes.
I did arts and humanities at uni. I think that's pretty evident.
And I just like to wear sequins. So let's go with what you've analysed.
Well, I thought when you put it, when you look at it from the perspective of the songwriters, that this is a song that speaks to a journey. Mm-hmm. And that journey could be from a space of sort of sadness, depression, or, you know, something perhaps not so positive into a more positive space.
Yep.
And, you know, that really reflects, I guess, in some ways, the migrant story that, you know, the writers went through at that time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was a conscious decision, because when you actually look and you can find some of the clips of these guys talking about the song, they don't reference that themselves.
I belong to a special tribe of what used to be called troubadours. Sometimes they were called minstrels. Now we're called songwriters. We worked for, in our songs, a sort of a better world, a rainbow world. Now, my generation, unfortunately, never succeeded in creating that rainbow world, so we can't hand it down to you. But we could hand down our songs, which still hang on to hope.
So, you know, I think sometimes with songwriting, it's not necessarily what you consciously believe. Obviously, what you write is informed by your experiences. But what I do think is really nice is that, you know, this might not be a migrant story, but that idea of traveling from one place to another place is very consistent with the story of The Wizard of Oz.
Incredibly.
She goes from Kansas.
Drab, black and white Kansas.
Into...
colourful Land of Oz.
Yeah, Technicolor.
And then back.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And sonically, when you look at the song as well, the way that it's been written, it kind of has what I call these leaps. So that first note.
Mm-hmm.
So that first note, that's a middle C, and then they jump from that all the way up to a top C. And it's almost this idea, this dichotomy of travelling from Kansas, this sort of darker, deeper, you know, more sort of depressing place, lacking colour, mm-hmm. into this like light fantasy space. And then if you look at the way the song is structured, it consistently has these leaps where it goes up an eighth, which is an octave, or it will go up a fifth.
Yeah.
And then it will sort of yearn back and head back down the keyboard and then do the jump again. And it's really kind of telling of the story of The Wizard of Oz. But it's also telling of, I guess, of what humanity goes through quite often.
Well, it pulls at the heartstrings.
Absolutely.
That whole song. And I'm not meaning to sound, you know, corny, but it really does pull at the heartstrings. As you say, the song is about hope, but it's also, I think, about focusing on what's in front of you as well. Because, I mean, Dorothy Gale, what the Judy Garland's character is based around, she's searching for something, but it's been in front of her the whole time.
Yeah.
Which I find quite fascinating.
And, you know, you kind of said something there about it being a story of hope.
Yes.
And I think that's really true because, you know, when I was thinking about this, you can interpret it as, you know, this migrant story. You can interpret it as the soundscape to a movie. And it does both of those things really well. But, you know, the reason why I think it transcends culture, the reason why it transcends time mm-hmm. is because it is that story of hope.
Yes.
And there are so many different versions of it.
Oh, my God, so many.
That keep popping up. And they keep popping up at, you know, really sad moments.
Yes.
So, you know, one of my favourite versions was done by Celine Dion.
Celine. Oh, my heart will go on.
Yes, love that.
Titanic plug.
And she did that when her mother passed away. She did a tribute on stage. And it was really lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And then... there was another version that was done around the same time, actually, by Ariana Grande.
Yes.
Which is perhaps a little bit more famous. And that version was done off the back of the Manchester
bombings.
Yeah.
At the concert.
Yeah.
Yes.
But do you know my favourite version of it, Brendy?
Because I'm about to tell you what my favourite version is, but yes, go ahead.
Oh, go, because it might be the same.
My favourite version was actually, and this was, again, really, really sad, but it was after the shooting happened in the gay bar over in America, and they held in Melbourne, there was a memorial ceremony at Federation Square. And I remember it was on a Wednesday, and it started at 5 o'clock, and I rushed from work to get to it. There were thousands of people there, and they brought a choir in, and we all sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And it was so good the first time that they're like, we're going to do it again. So we did it twice. It was so moving just to hear the whole of Federation Square singing this song. It was just incredible.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. It's this thing that we come back to almost as a cultural reference point at those moments of sadness. My favorite version of it, though, perhaps not as meaningful, but the beast,
like Glee.
No, it's only a step removed from Glee. I must admit.
Jane Lynch singing it.
No, step removed from Glee. Slightly better, I hope. The B-side. To Ricky Lee's debut single, Hell No.
Oh, anything Ricky Lee sings is great.
Amazing.
Hey, Ricky.
But so the B-side to that was a version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I really need to give you this context because I find it incredibly kind of crazy and interesting. But Ricky Lee, when she was on Australian Idol, voted out 7th. Justice for Ricky Lee, hashtag.
Yes. Yes, love is all around.
Yes, absolutely. She was known on Australian Idol for, you know, the big ballads. She had the voice, and she did this beautiful version of I Have Nothing by Whitney Houston. And she was known for those songs. And then she kind of signed with an independent record label, came out with this R&B Hell No single. Mm-hmm. And they realized from a marketing perspective, they need something that's still true to what she did on the show.
Okay.
So she recorded Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And to come back into the public's mind, she appeared on Celebrities Run Away with the Circus, which you may not remember.
Definitely do not remember that, no.
But Ricky Lee, it was basically a bunch of celebrities who joined the circus.
Yay.
And Ricky Lee, I don't know what she did. I can't remember if it was like trapeze or something, but there was a lot of like overcoming her fears. And that song, or her version of that song, featured quite prominently in the TV show. So we're going to move on from The Wizard of Oz now. In 2019, Renee Zellweger played the role of Judy Garland in Judy.
Judy. Incredible.
Amazing.
Oh my God. I was a mess at the cinema at the end.
It's such a moving portrayal. And then the other biopic, which we're not going to call a movie because, oh my God.
It is long. You think it's a movie? No, it's a four-part miniseries, let's be honest.
Absolutely. And if you go to some popular video streaming sites on the internet, you can actually find it.
You can, or if you still have a DVD player.
You can borrow Brendy's copy. Get in touch with us and Brendy will lend you his copy. That version, Life with Judy Garland, Me and My Shadows, is actually based on a book that her daughter Lorna Luft wrote.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, it's very interesting because you can analyze Judy Garland's life through her art and what she produced. Or you could look at these biopics, which kind of do exactly what she did, or Dorothy Gale did at the end of The Wizard of Oz, and look behind the curtain.
Yes.
And show us that life. So, you know, I think they have a number of key kind of things that stand out in those movies, Brendy.
What do I think stands out?
Yeah.
I guess for me, what stands out... firstly, I'll start with Me and My Shadows. Me and My Shadows, I absolutely loved when it first came out. I was addicted to it. I mean, I was... Why I ever even had to come out myself. I remember getting this, getting the DVD and just watching it again and again and again. It was obviously a long journey. What I loved about that movie was Judy Davis's harshness in her portrayal. And when I say harshness, I mean that in a positive sense of just nothing was hidden. There was no, there was no sort of polishing of anything. It was just what you see is what you get. And I think that's what Judy Garland was actually all about.
Yeah.
Unapologetically. I mean, I don't think she expected, obviously, for her life to be slammed all over the media. But I think she was pretty much one of the very first stars that the media just ripped shreds off. And, I mean, we see it nowadays all the time on social media and whatnot. But her life, nothing was private in her life. Everything that was happening... was always publicized, and the media would thrive off anything that was negative. So you continually saw the breakdown of her relationships, all the different engagements that she was possibly going to have that were called off. Obviously all of the drug addiction and the booze, her up and down weight, her family problems, the fact that her mother was a complete stage mum. I think her mother was the original stage mum. And, her mother is the one that put her on pep pills at the age of 6. So why is it any wonder that later on in life she's trying to do movies and concerts and she's under so much pressure and she has to resort to medications?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about that as members of the LGBTIQA plus community...
Yes.
...is that that makes her terribly, terribly human.
Incredibly human.
And as a result, I think... a level of empathy, mm-hmm. connection, recognition of ourselves, and some of the battles that we potentially go through.
Absolutely able to relate.
Absolutely. Relatable, I think, is a key thing.
Real.
And you can kind of see, you look at other artists, some do it genuinely, some perhaps not as genuinely, but they try and replicate that connection with their fan base by being authentic and by being real and removing that fourth wall.
Yep.
And, social media facilitates that a lot, but... Judy Garland, I think at the time probably her whole approach to the media was like to shrug it off, like, I don't care. But it did bring her closer to her, to the community, to her fans who could love her for her artistry, but also, have that empathy and that connection at a more emotional level. And I think in the Renee Zellweger version of Judy,
yes.
There's this beautiful scene where Judy Garland has dinner with two of her fans. Dan and Stan. Such original names. Dan and Stan, yeah. And I can't remember if it's Dan or Stan, but one of them tries to cook her scrambled eggs.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really...
it's just a mess.
It's really bad. But she just... it's this beautiful moment which she, like, connects with them at a really human level. And she removes the fourth wall. She looks behind the curtain and just opens up and connects and is vulnerable with her fans. And I just thought, it's hard to kind of... That's a fictional story.
It's a fictional story. But I think what I loved in that scene just quickly was the fact that... she is vulnerable with them, but they're also vulnerable with her. And I think that's why she's able to be vulnerable with Dan and Stan. And it's Dan and Stan, even though it is fictional, the two characters, as we've said earlier on, they replicate our community supporting her.
Absolutely.
And then she supports us. And you see it in the concerts, in the fact that Dan and Stan are at every single concert.
Yeah. It's a real two-way kind of relationship.
100%.
Which I think was unique at the time because, as we were saying, a lot of the celebrities of the era came out of that MGM and that movie studio sausage machine almost.
Yes.
So to develop authentic relationships, really there's only a handful that did that, and Garland stands out.
And as I said, like everything that was coming out of MGM or any of the Hollywood studios, even like, Marilyn Monroe and whatnot, a lot of the stars were, again, as I said, smoke and mirrors. Everything looked fabulous. Everything looked happy. They had, the studio bought them the cars and the houses, and they had to look perfect, and they weren't allowed any bad publicity. And Judy Garland was one of those ones that all of a sudden was kind of, you know, the fallen star, and they just latched onto it. And then, yeah, Marilyn Monroe was kind of the next one. But it's those figures that, as you say, that are relatable.
Absolutely.
They're not the, you know, Joan Crawford looked perfect. And then it was until the 80s when, after she died, that her daughter brought out Mummy Dearest. And then, you know, Ryan Murphy did the show Feud about the making of her and Joan Crawford and Betty Davis being in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And you realise that these two women had so many insecurities. And you're like, oh my God, you were handed the world on a platter, but you're actually real and you've got so many other issues. I don't know, it just becomes very, very relatable. So I look at Joan Crawford in a different eye and Betty Davis as well. And
but so circling back to the Judy movie and, yes. and that fictional moment of her having dinner with the gay couple, I think sometimes, like you were saying, you have these moments where an art may depict something that didn't actually happen, but it reflects the emotional tone or, you know, reflects yes. something that is real.
Yeah.
And, you know, Garland did have a very special connection with her gay community. And, you know, that played out in a number of ways. And we don't need to, hopefully we don't need to tell people about Stonewall. But there is a very interesting moment in the 60s where she's interviewed mm-hmm. Just on, you know, NBC or something like that. And the interviewer, well, actually, how about we listen to it?
Let's do it.
Time magazine in a recent story said that Judy Garland, for some reason, which was not clear to me, attracts a lot of homosexuals in her
life. Oh, I think that's the most ridiculous thing, because I have, in my audiences, I have little children who, you know, from seeing the Wizard of Oz, and I have, strangely enough now, I have many teenagers and then people my age, and the woman who interviewed that was really quite unhappy that I was a hit, and she also had a few problems of her own. She was talk about homosexuals. Well, she was a fella. Shall we say that?
She's a jolly good fellow. But this is an unusual charge I've never heard leveled at in describing an audience. Of
well, I don't mind, you know, for so many years I've been misquoted and rather brutally treated by the press, but I'll be damned if I like to have my audience mistreated.
Do you have any ambition?
So, Brendy and I are kind of in two minds about this, because I'll let you go first, Brendy.
Well, I think it's a great interview in regards to her response. I think the interviewer is trying to pry something out of her, and I personally think that Judy sort of shuts it down, and she's she loves her fans, and she sees her fans as her fans.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I think when I first heard it,
yes,
I was kind of like, did she kind of step up for the gay community at that point? Like, I didn't have that immediate kind of connection. And I listened to it a few times, and then I kind of came to this space of, well, I'm judging it from the perspective of an openly gay man living in 2020.
Yeah.
And you know, Lady Gaga will get up there and, you know, scream, you know, equality. Absolutely. But back in the 60s, it was a totally different context. And we need to remember that our gay forefathers and members of the community didn't have, you know, the same opportunities to be themselves and express themselves. And I think even in Garland's response and the way that she manages it, she does what you were saying. Mm-hmm. She does step up for the community, but she does, you know, she almost has to do it carefully.
But she'd also always been a part of the community. So I don't know if people know, but her dad was gay, and her mother found out when Judy was actually, I think, only about 3 or 6 years old that the father was gay. Judy was rumoured to be bisexual. Judy had a lot of gay friends, and even when she was in the movie set in the studios, she'd go out to gay bars. So she was always around the gay scene. She gave birth to Liza Minnelli. Like, yes. Hello.
And one of the things I got from the Me and My Shadows, that movie, was that of her five husbands,
yes,
two of them, now I can't do maths, but that's like 40%? Yes, it's 40%.
Yeah.
Of her husbands...
were gay.
Yes.
She introduced Liza to Peter Allen.
Yes.
And that was Liza's first husband, aka Australian gay icon.
And I wonder...
yes.
...if it's because... well, firstly, Lorna laughed when she was questioned on this.
Yeah.
She was like, sometimes my mother couldn't tell the difference between the affection of a gay man and sort of romantic attention.
Yes.
And you put that in the context of a time when people are still in the closet and having these relationships.
Yep.
Purely, what do they call them?
Lavender marriages.
Yes. So when people are having lavender relationships, marriages, putting in that context, you know, somebody, you can see how it happens.
Of course you do.
Yeah. Because there is genuine affection and love, but perhaps not romantic love.
Yeah.
But thank God she married Vincent Minnelli, is all I'm saying. These movies, they do a really good job in very different ways. I think the biopic, which is based on the Lorna Luft book, which, yes, you know, so it's
Judy Davis,
a much more, I guess, accurate portrayal, honest portrayal. It tries to replicate what happened in reality.
Yeah.
In a very honest way.
And it's her whole life.
Yeah, her
whole life. You will be exhausted by the end of it.
Yeah. But then the Renee Zellweger film.
Yes, being focuses around the last 6 months of her life in London.
And her concerts, concert series that she did. So she very successfully in the early 60s did a string of concerts in London.
Oh my God, yes.
And they were amazing, and you can listen to them on your favorite streaming apps. Yes, so the Judy the Renee Zellweger tries to take a moment in time and then fictionalizes it in kind of the same way that something like The Crown would. You know, there are elements of truth, but it is a fictitious recounting, and that allows the movie to do a whole heap of things in terms of reflecting the relationship with the gay community, like the Stan and Dan story, which didn't actually happen, but, you know, it reflects an emotional landscape. They both do a fantastic job in reflecting and entertaining at the same time.
Absolutely. They won lots of awards.
And connecting, yes, absolutely. But, you know, going back to Judy's life and what she meant to, you know, we've talked about what she meant to us as individuals, but her legacy.
Yes.
And what she means to the world. So what does Judy Garland's life mean to you, Brendy?
My favourite Judy moment was when I was cast in my very first musical in 2013, and I was in the ensemble. I'd been rehearsing for quite some time, but it got to tech week. I was in the dressing room getting myself ready. We were all setting up our costumes and whatnot, and I had my basket worth of costumes with me. And I'd pop them down, and I quickly get a tap on the shoulder and told to move my stuff because that's where the other guys had set up. So I move it to the other side of the dressing room. I get another tap. I'm told to move again.
Aww.
And then I'm told to move a third time, and I'm like, where the hell am I going to hang my clothes, set myself up? Because we're in a tiny dressing room, there is about 12 of us guys, and everyone's just telling me where to go. So I went home that night, and I'm in the car, and I pulled out Judy Garland's album, as I have done many a times, and went through the motions of her album, because I was just feeling slightly rejected. All of a sudden, I had a bit of an epiphany, and I knew exactly what I was going to do. Next day, I walk into the theatre, into the dressing room, and I find the toilet cubicle. I whack a piece of paper on it that says Brendy's dressing room with a gold star. I've announced to everyone, gentlemen, you wouldn't let me sit or set myself up with any of you. So I now have my own dressing room. I walk into my cubicle, I slam the door, put a picture of Judy Garland up on the wall. And 6 months later, I ended up getting nominated for an musical theatre award for best cameo in a musical, even though I was in the ensemble.
Bravo to you.
You.
For that, and just like Brendy's beautiful musical, that is the end of our first episode of Bubbles and Pop. You can follow us on Instagram. Just look up Bubbles_and_pop. And you can tune in next time where we'll be talking about the one and only, the very fabulous... Cher! Exactly like that the entire way through.
The whole way.
That has been the first episode of Bubbles and Pop. Whatever you may be drinking, cheers to that.
Cheers.
For this episode of Bubbles and Pop, we need to recognise some fantastic websites and YouTube sites.
We really do, Mikey.
These guys made today's episode possible. Like to recognise Robert Lewison and his fantastic tribute to Judy Garland. And of course, Channel 9 for the much underrated and underloved and underappreciated show, Celebrities Runaway with the Circus.